This is Professor Richard Nagaretta at Vanderbilt University Law School. I'm going to be talking today about the oral argument that the Supreme Court just heard in a case called Taylor versus Sturgill. The court heard argument earlier this week on April the 16th. The Taylor case addresses the outer limits of preclusion in civil litigation, in particular litigation that seeks to vindicate a public right under some public statute. Now, the bedrock starting point here is the notion that a civil judgment on the merits precludes a second lawsuit on the same cause of action, but only when the second lawsuit involves the same parties or people who are in privity with a party to the first lawsuit. The Taylor case deals with a controversial extension of this privity notion in the context of preclusion, especially in the setting of litigation under the Freedom of Information Act. And the extension is known as the doctrine of virtual representation. That's the somewhat vague name given to this under procedural doctrine. And the basic idea is that some relationships between litigants might not literally rise to the level of a contractual relationship in the ordinary privity sense, but nonetheless are relationships such that litigant number two should be precluded from suing based on the judgment against litigant number one. As I mentioned, this is a quite controversial notion in procedure for reasons that I'll talk about in a moment. The story of Taylor versus Sturgill actually begins well before Mr. Brent Taylor enters the picture. Both Mr. Taylor and a second individual by the name of Greg Herrick were members of an organization called the Antique Aircraft Association. This is basically an association composed of people who are interested in the restoration of antique airplanes. Herrick, in fact, owns an F-45 plane that was manufactured by a predecessor of the current company known as Fairchild Corporation. Herrick wants to restore this plane, and as part of his restoration efforts, Herrick files a FOIA request to try to obtain the plans and specifications for the F-45 plane. He files this with the U.S. government, specifically the Federal Aviation Administration. Of course, the FAA keeps these sorts of plans and specifications for licensed flying aircraft on hand. So Herrick files a FOIA request to get the plans and specs. The FAA denies Herrick's FOIA request on the ground that the plans and specifications are a trade secret of Fairchild Corporation, and on that basis, says the FAA, disclosure, these plans and specifications are exempt from disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. Now, Herrick challenges, as he's permitted to do, he challenges the denial of his FOIA request before the U.S. District Court for the District of Wyoming, and then he takes the matter up to the Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit, both of which uphold the denial. They agree with the government's position that these plans and specifications need not be disclosed under FOIA. Well, what happens then? About a month later, after the proceedings with respect to Mr. Herrick's request are over, Brent Taylor files a FOIA request seeking the very same plans and specifications for the F-45 plane. There's evidence in the record that at the very least, Herrick, the earlier losing requester, had requested Taylor to help him with the restoration of Herrick's F-45 plane. Indeed, Taylor, the second requester, uses the same lawyer as Herrick had used to make his FOIA request. Nonetheless, there is no evidence that Herrick was financing Taylor's request. There's no evidence that Herrick controlled Taylor's litigation. Both FOIA requests, the first one by Herrick and the second one by Taylor, are made by those persons in their individual capacities. These are not requests made on behalf of the Antique Aircraft Association. They're simply two individual citizen requests. Well, what happens to Taylor's request? Well, not surprisingly, the Federal Aviation Administration denies Taylor's request for the same reason that it denied Herrick's earlier request. So what does Taylor do? Taylor challenges the denial, except this time he challenges it in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, not the same court that Herrick's challenge was brought. And the matter then goes up to the Federal Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Both of those courts conclude that Taylor's challenge to the denial of his FOIA request is precluded by the earlier adverse judgment against Mr. Herrick. And the basis for preclusion, says the D.C. Circuit, is this notion of virtual representation. Now, I mentioned that this is a controversial idea, a controversial basis for preclusion, precisely because it involves a deviation from the basic notion that only someone who is a party to an earlier lawsuit or someone who is in privity with that party is precluded from suing a second time on the same matter. Now, the major difficulty with this notion of virtual preclusion is how to cabin that notion, how to prevent it from undermining this general principle that only parties and their privities can be precluded. Well, the D.C. Circuit tried to cabin the virtual representation idea. They said, well, there's identity of interest between Herrick, the earlier requester, and Taylor, the second requester. Both of them did want the same information, the plans and specifications, and they wanted it for the same reasons, so that Herrick could restore his F-45 plane. The D.C. Circuit also said that Taylor's interests were adequately represented by Herrick with regard to the first request. Herrick, said the D.C. Circuit, had every reason to litigate his FOIA request just as vigorously as Taylor would have an interest in doing. In addition, the D.C. Circuit noted, there's at least some evidence of a close relationship between Herrick, the first requester, and Taylor, the second requester. Again, this notion that they're part of the same antique aircraft association, there clearly seems to be some level of interaction and dealing between Herrick and Taylor. The justices of the Supreme Court appeared quite skeptical, really across ideological lines, about the broad implications of the D.C. Circuit's embrace of this notion of virtual representation. At the same time, several of the justices, particularly Chief Justice Roberts, were also concerned about the potential for considerable repeat litigation, particularly in a context like FOIA. The basic problem here is that FOIA confers an undifferentiated right on the public generally, a right to seek the release of information that the government is holding. Indeed, a right, as Justice Scalia points out, to seek the release of that information for no particular reason, for no reason other than just pure curiosity. It is a right conferred upon the public generally. There's no specification of the forum for a lawsuit if you want to challenge the denial of your FOIA request. You can, there are a number of different fora that you can sue in, where you live, so forth. Here, this is why you had the initial lawsuit by Herrick in the district court for the District of Wyoming, and then Taylor's suit coming up in a different federal court for the District of Columbia. The major concern with using virtual representation, this preclusion doctrine, to shut down the second litigation is that the virtual representation doctrine is quite amorphous. It requires, even on the D.C. Circuit's analysis, a very fact-laden, very context-specific sort of analysis just to figure out whether litigant number two is precluded. It doesn't lend itself to the sort of relatively clear, categorical, easy-to-apply rules that one would think one would want for a preliminary ruling on preclusion. One alternative approach here was suggested by Justice Stevens, who asked, well, why can't the doctrine of stare decisis address this concern over repeated litigation over the same matters? Of course, for stare decisis is not a preclusion notion, it's an idea on the merits, that with regard to matters that have been litigated before, albeit by different parties, with no relationship of privity or otherwise, we prefer that like cases be decided in a like manner. But it is not a preclusion doctrine. It's a doctrine of how the merits ought to be resolved. And when Justice Stevens raised this concern at oral argument, counsel for Fairchild pointed out that while there's a big practical difference between shutting a lawsuit down on preclusion grounds and shutting it down on ultimately at the end of the road based on some notion of stare decisis, the defendant, and of course Fairchild is quite concerned about whether this information gets released here or not, under a stare decisis approach, the defendant has to go through litigation on the merits with regard to the second challenge. So while the stare decisis approach would seem to provide a conceptual hook for the notion of why the second lawsuit should lose on the same grounds that the first one does, its practical implications are rather different, because it is not, unlike virtual representation, a preclusion type of argument. There are suggestions by some of the other justices that perhaps there should be some differentiation made between actual collusion situations where you have financing of the second lawsuit by the first litigant, where you have perhaps some level of control of the second lawsuit by the first litigant, to distinguish those types of collusive situations from lesser degrees of cooperation. A number of the justices pressed counsel on that notion. Another possible approach is suggested by the questioning that Chief Justice Roberts actually subjected counsel on both sides to. Chief Justice Roberts came back repeatedly to the notion that, well, these are individual actions here, both Herrick's actions and Taylor's actions. What seemed to interest Chief Justice Roberts the most in this case is, well, what if the first lawsuit had been brought on grounds of associational standing? Is it really the case that every individual member of the association, if the association loses in the first lawsuit, or someone suing on behalf of the association loses on the first lawsuit, does that really mean that, you know, every individual member can bring a lawsuit over the same matters? So you can see that this seemingly technical and obscure notion of virtual representation in this rather odd context of FOIA is a matter of concern to the justices precisely because it has implications in so many areas, including, I might add, at least some indirect repercussions, depending on what the court says, in the area of class action litigation. In an amicus brief, Professor David Shapiro, joined by a number of other distinguished academics, said that part of the problem here in the D.C. Circuit's analysis is that they're, in effect, treating the first lawsuit as if it were kind of like a class action, precluding other similarly situated people, but all without the kind of procedural protections and class oversight of the class action by the court in the first proceeding. My inference from the oral argument is that the Supreme Court is pretty likely to overturn the D.C. Circuit's decision. One relatively narrower approach would be to simply remand the case for further determinations about the exact relationship between Herrick and Taylor, whether we might very well be in something that really looks like a collusive type of situation rather than the more informal relationship that has been revealed thus far. Another possible approach, again, which would overturn the D.C. Circuit, would be to reject the virtual representation notion and to try to inject some of the distinctions that I raised earlier, distinguishing actual collusion situations from lesser degrees of cooperation that would not result in preclusion, perhaps with some additional discussion to distinguish the situation of associational standing cases. Both sides in the Taylor versus Sturgill case noted the dissatisfaction that the FOIA context generates. The notion that because FOIA provides an undifferentiated right on all members of the public to seek the release of information, that it does give rise to this potential for relitigation across multiple fora. Both sides noted that if this is really a problem, perhaps this is something that really ought to be revisited by Congress in designing the statute, in some ways to circumscribe at least the fora in which these various challenges can be brought. But at least many of the justices seem receptive to the notion that that should be done by Congress by way of statutory amendment, not by the courts through this problematic doctrine of virtual representation. There's one larger point, I think, that should be borne in mind with regard to this case, and that is that, at least in my view, this is an instance, in a rather unusual context, of a more general problem in the law today that's not been well pinpointed in the courts or in academic writing, for that matter. I would label it broadly as the problem of what I would call embedded aggregation. And here's the problem. The usual concern raised in civil litigation is over the imposition of aggregation in situations like class certification, for example. The concern is, well, that aggregation is being imposed. The Taylor case raises, in some ways, a rather different concern, a concern that you have an individual lawsuit, a nominally individual lawsuit, but that it's a lawsuit in functional terms that, in practical effect, and as a normative matter, perhaps ought to have some effect on other persons, persons who aren't before the court and are not therefore subject to various procedural protections, as if they were in an actual certified class action. My suggestion is that there's something like this same problem of what to do about a situation of embedded aggregation. What to do when an individual lawsuit in some meaningful sense is really not just purely an individual lawsuit. We see similar problems in a number of areas that have not been sort of brought together in our thinking. One can see some of this in the area of punitive damages. The Supreme Court's decision in Philip Morris versus Williams holds that in an individual tort case seeking punitive damages, the jury can consider the effects of the defendant's conduct on people besides this particular plaintiff, similar consumers, similarly situated people, but only to evaluate the reprehensibility of the defendant's conduct as to this plaintiff, not to punish the defendant for its conduct with respect to people who are not before the court and as to whom the defendant cannot sort of get into their particular situations. That's one situation also where there's something like this embedded aggregation problem. Think also of employment discrimination litigation involving allegations of a pattern or practice of discrimination on the part of the defendant employer. Interestingly enough, there is now some lower court precedent saying that if you're bringing a pattern or practice employment discrimination claim, that that claim can only be brought as a class action. It cannot be brought as an individual action precisely because the theory of liability speaks to a pattern of misconduct by the defendant over a large number of people, not just the individual plaintiff who's bringing the individual action. A third situation where there's something like this problem of embedded aggregation going on. The long-running debate about civil settlements in individual lawsuits that have or impose some manner of secrecy, perhaps with respect to, let's say, documents that were exchanged by the parties in discovery. There is a long-standing concern about what the real limits ought to be on the ability of an individual litigant to enter into a civil settlement that has these sort of secrecy provisions that would make it a lot more difficult, perhaps, for other similar litigants to find out about the situation, to bring a lawsuit. The situation is one in which the initial settling litigant can, in a technical sense, really impose a kind of externality on other similarly situated people. What I'm suggesting is that Taylor in the context of FOIA, this notion of virtual representation is actually raising, in a rather unusual context, a more general problem, a problem of embedded aggregation that I dare say our civil justice system has not well identified, but is dealing with in a variety of different contexts that have not been sort of pulled together and understood as presenting similar sorts of problems. Now, I dare say that the Supreme Court will not go so far as to embrace a discussion of all of these other areas, but that is why I think that what the court has to say about this rather technical, seemingly, question of virtual representation is something of potentially broader significance in the law. Thanks.